Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to think like a human? And how close might digital processors someday come to imitating the way our brains manage information? In 1950, a British mathematician named Alan Turing famously predicted that by the year 2000, artificial intelligence programs could fool at least 30% of judges into thinking they were communicating with living, breathing humans. For the past 20 years, human contestants and computer programmers have gathered to give judges a chance to test that theory in an annual competition called the Loebner Prize, which rewards both the most human-like computer and the real person who is most clearly not a computer. Writer Brian Christian won the Human Prize in 2009. He holds degrees in poetry, philosophy, and computer science. His work has appeared in literary and scientific publications, including The Atlantic, McSweeney's, and the peer-reviewed journal Cognitive Science. His new book is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Brian, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
One of the most remarkable insights in this book is really about human intelligence and how many of our abilities we take for granted. Can you talk for a minute about what is easy for us but very hard even for the most sophisticated computers right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think really that's been the story of AI. It's kind of these verdicts coming into us on what we thought was easy turning out to be hard and what we thought was hard turning out to be easy. So, I mean, I think a really clear example is if you look at the IBM Jeopardy competition with their supercomputer, Watson. What we find really impressive about a Jeopardy whiz like Ken Jennings or Brad Rutter is how much knowledge they seem to have. You know, they seem to just know everything. For a computer program, you know, for the IBM team that was designing Watson, that really wasn't the challenge. It wasn't considered particularly difficult or impressive to them to have all of those facts on hand. What they found so challenging was understanding what the clues were getting at, sort of deciphering Alex Trebek's puns. And it's this ability to use language in a sort of natural, everyday way, which we really take for granted, that turns out to be extremely complicated. And AI has really shown us that.
And artificial intelligence is also evolving in different ways from our own knowledge. So, for example, while computers have been flying airplanes for decades now, it would be pretty much hopeless for a computer to try to pilot something as low-tech as a bicycle.
And yes, exactly. That we have the ability to fly planes partially because flying a plane is extremely complicated, but it is rule-based because the air is more or less regular, whereas driving in an urban setting or riding a bicycle through traffic requires a sort of presence of mind of being on guard for anything at any time. You know, a cat could jump out or someone could open a car door. And it's this quality of sort of not necessarily having a strict policy of how to ride the bike, but being constantly open to, you know, the random chaos of life and needing to react on the spot. That makes it so difficult.
Yeah, I was thinking about that Google project where they're experimenting with making a car that drives itself, and I was wondering what it's like to be the first human to jump into a car that is run by a computer.
I would imagine a little bit nerve-wracking. I mean, you know, a bit like a driving ed instructor must feel. You know, you're lucky to have that emergency brake pedal, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I think the same thing actually is happening with the Google cars. The person in the car still has the ability to take over if something random happens.
Right.
So another thing you point out here is that the term computer was once actually applied to humans. It was a job description for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think to help understand this sort of anxiety that people now feel comparing themselves to computers, yeah, it's important to realize that the original computers were people, that from the 18th century up to about 1950, there was a job called computer, which was basically a numerical analyst. So there would be these rooms of computers, these people working on everything from calculating the return of Halley's Comet in the 1860s up through the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos.
Now, in those situations, you can see where the development of a digital device to do some of this would make perfect sense. I mean, human beings get tired, they get sick, they get grouchy, they want more money. Whereas if you can put a machine to work on certain kinds of calculations, where, as you mentioned earlier, there are just rules to be followed, it's good for all of us, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, assuming that we can keep the former human computers employed, which mm-hmm. is sort of a societal rather than a philosophical question. But yes, I think, it's very fascinating to listen to the pioneers of computer science describing these new digital devices that they've just invented, which, of course, no one has ever seen before. And so their description is, you can imagine these things, says Alan Turing, as being kind of like a computer, which is this very amusing way of describing it. It's kind of like a person who does math for a living. And I think what we're seeing, is professional mathematicians, for example, are now, I think, fortunately, much more able to spend their time on the more sort of creative or metaphorical aspects of the job, trying to sort of map one problem domain into the other, and can allow their mechanical device to do all the grunt work.
And when you talk about creativity, that's another place where computers lag far behind human beings.
Yeah, that's right. I think, part of it is that the challenge of art is the challenge of trying to survey the landscape of what already exists and look for a way to make sort of a unique contribution or to push the field forward. And all of that runs, pretty counter to what we typically expect from a computer, which is to perform the same procedure over and over and over and, achieve the same result. Whereas art is all about, reacting to what exists and trying to create something totally fresh.
Talk about Alan Turing for a minute. What led him to that famous prediction that we talked about in 1950?
Well, this was after World War II. Alan Turing had been involved in the British effort to crack the German Enigma code. And in doing so, he had developed what was really going to turn into the modern computer. And already he was asking these very philosophical questions. Can these things actually think? We can use them to crunch numbers, but can they actually think in the human sense? And his answer was, I'm going to set aside these philosophical ways of answering that question, and I just want to have a practical test. And so he comes up with what's famously now known as the Turing test, which is this idea that you'll convene a panel of scientists. They'll have these 5-minute conversations where they're sending text messages back and forth. But what they don't know is, are these text messages that are appearing on their screens coming from a real person that's basically sequestered in a room down the hall, or are they coming from a computer program pretending to be a person sequestered in a room down the hall? And it was Turing's intuition that by about the year 2000, these computer programs would be fooling the judges about 30% of the time. And as a result, if we couldn't tell the difference between this machine intelligence and real intelligence, that to some extent we'd have to admit that they actually were intelligent.
And to go back and talk a little about the evolution of artificial intelligence programs, one thing that took people by surprise was this program that was called ELIZA in the 1960s. Acted as a sort of computer therapist for people.
That's right, yeah. So the very first, what's called chatbot, which is a software simulation of human conversation, was written by an MIT professor named Joseph Weizenbaum in the 1960s. And he called it ELIZA, and it was really modeled after this sort of Rogerian, non-directive psychotherapist where, you say, I'm feeling very depressed, and it says, I'm sorry to hear you're depressed. Why are you depressed? Mm-hmm. You say, well, I'm having a fight with my mother, and it'll say, oh, well, tell me more about your mother. So really it's functioning almost in a kind of Mad Libs way where it's seizing on certain words and then just kind of flipping them back to you.
But
the really amazing thing was, ELIZA was written in the 60s with just several hundred lines of computer code. It was very rudimentary. But the author, Joseph Weizenbaum, found members of his staff talking to the ELISA program, in some cases for hours, and reporting that they'd had this sort of very meaningful, kind of intimate therapeutic experience where they'd really sort of made some progress. And that to Weizenbaum, I mean, was both fascinating as a scientist, but actually to him sort of horrifying and appalling that people really seem to kind of get emotionally attached to what he thought of as a very simple piece of software. And so he ended up ultimately, in fact, becoming one of the great critics of artificial intelligence. So it's one of the rare cases in academia of someone basically doing a 180, a reversal of their career, and turning into the biggest and most outspoken opponent of his own former research.
But in that case, the chat bot was out of the bag, to mix metaphors. It was certainly going to continue, and people sort of picked up on the work with ELISA that Weizenbaum had done and did more.
Yeah, that's right. It was, yeah, the genie was sort of out of the bottle, or however you'd want to put it, that really this model that Weizenbaum invented of sort of keyword matching became the template for many, many chatbots to follow. And at the same time, the actual psychotherapeutic community started looking at this and saying, you know, I wonder, you know, this technology is just in its infancy, but perhaps there's something really to this. Perhaps we can invent, you know, you read these papers from the 60s and 70s, and they're envisioning these sort of ELISA-based therapeutic phone booths where you can sort of put in a couple quarters and have, you know, a half-an-hour session with a computer therapist.
Did it matter whether or not people believed it was a real person or understood that they were speaking with a computer?
It seemed to be that they even those people who were familiar with Weizenbaum as a programmer and sort of saw him writing it, that even they seemed to be somewhat taken in by the program. Now, granted, this was the 60s, so I don't know if you'd see quite the same thing today. But there was this real tendency to treat it, even sort of despite your own thinking to the contrary, that you would sort of ascribe this emotionality to it.
Which forces us, of course, to think about whether or not there ought to be more humanity in the conversations that, say, therapists in the 60s were having with their patients.
Well, I think that's right. And that was certainly Weizenbaum's critique, was he said, you know, what must a therapist think that he's doing when he's talking with his clients if this mechanical parody can suffice? And so for me, you know, one of the major themes of the book is the way in which creating these approximations of human conversation or these kind of simplified models forces us to really go back and think about, well, what is it that makes a conversation good? You know, what is it that we really want when we interact with other humans?
And one of the things that was discovered as the technology progressed was that it's really easy to seem human if you program a computer to be verbally abusive.
Yes, that's right. So one of the fascinating chapters in the history of chatbots is at the end of the 80s, there was a Dublin University undergraduate named Mark Humphreys, who had mocked up his own sort of ELISA-style program to basically act as a kind of answering machine. And he was shocked to find, in some cases, users arguing with it for an hour and a half.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. Brian Christian is my guest. He is a writer with degrees in poetry, philosophy, and computer science. His new book is called The Most Human Human: What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Our conversation continues in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs, camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos, held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Brian Christian. His new book is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or have your chatbot send an email to think@kera.org. One of the reasons that Mark Humphrey's chatbot was so effective, Brian, is the fact that those abusive conversations where the bot was sort of responding in rude ways to whatever was said are what you call stateless, meaning that they really each interjection by the computer really only refers to what was just said. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the principles behind a lot of what the chatbot programmers are after is this idea of called statelessness, which is that it's much easier to field a question when the answer only depends on the question itself. So we can think of something like Jeopardy as an example, where you can really take each clue on its own, that it doesn't really matter which clues you get in which order, or if you subtract some or add others, it really is not going to affect the answer. It's only going to depend on what was just said. That's much easier for a computer system to handle than something like natural conversation, where you sort of build up this increasing amount of context that's going to add sort of some critical nuance to how you have to answer the question. And as it turns out, there are certain types of human conversations that are stateless. And one of the classic examples, as it has turned out, is verbal abuse, or the sort of heated rhetoric, flame wars, as they're known on the Internet.
Yeah.
And so it became one of the goals of Mark Humphrey's to see if he could induce basically flame war behavior in humans that were conversing with his program. And when he could, it worked sort of eerily well, where the computer program would sling some sort of a barb at the human. The human would defensively respond with some sort of counter barb, and it would just sort of keep going back and forth without any real subject matter or, you know, arc of the conversation.
At the same time, a real human argument or a regular conversation would definitely refer back not only to things within the conversation, but to things that had happened before. For example, if someone were to say, oh, well, I'm wearing the red dress tonight. Now, someone that knows them well might say, oh, well, that's the dress you wore the first time we went out or the first time we did something. And there would be other elements to that conversation that maybe don't even get spoken, but that both parties understand.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that's part of what makes longstanding human relationships so valuable, is that there's this really rich, compressed context. You know, you can sort of imagine overhearing people talking, and they say things like, you know, so have you talked to her yet? You know, or have you done the thing? Or, you know, in this very compressed, sort of pronoun-ish, vague way, but they're completely aware of what they're talking about. Whereas with computer systems, you frequently have to come in and give them the entire context with every single question.
So let's talk a little bit about your experience in the contest. First of all, how were you able to sign on and be what's called a confederate in this contest?
Yeah, that's right. So in 2008, my ears really perked up when I saw that the computer programs at the 2008 contest had managed to fool 3 out of the 12 judges, which is just one vote shy of Alan Turing's famous 30% mark. And I really felt this strange sense of wanting to intervene, wanting to prevent 2009 from being the year that they finally crossed that threshold. And so I got in touch with the organizers, and I basically said, you know, I'm really invested in this. I've got a background in computer science and philosophy and poetry. I think I'd be a pretty good candidate to be a part of the human defense, and they readily agreed. Before I knew it, my name was on what's known as the Confederate roster. So I was going to be headed to England at the end of 2009 as one of 4 representative Homo sapiens asked to converse with this panel of judges and convince them that we were, in fact, human, which is, of course, a very strange position to find yourself in.
What I found hilarious was that you were told, well, don't bother prepping, just show up and be yourself, and you didn't feel like that was enough.
I had a sense that perhaps it wouldn't be enough, that, you know, of course, as a socialized human being, I have this, you know, developed intuition about how to hold a conversation, like as we all do. But of course, we know from our own experience that not every conversation is always as successful as we hope it would be. And I was really only going to have these four very short conversations with total strangers. And so part of my motivation was the sense of, you know, I don't necessarily want to leave it up to chance whether we hit it off or not. I want to see if there's something I can do to make sure that these conversations go off well. And part of it was that I knew the human contestants had had such a narrow squeeze in 2008 that the computers had fooled the judges a number of times. And so I wanted to do what I could to give the best performance that I could.
For people who are wondering about this, the programmers have been savvy enough to program in things like typos so that that's not an obvious giveaway.
Yeah. There have been a number of these very sort of devious tricks that the programmers have kind of woven into the programs where they'll build in sort of jokes, so the program will be cracking these jokes. It will be making typos and then backspacing them. And so the more that I looked back across the history of the Turing test and looking at what are the conversations where the judges made the wrong decision about which was the human, the more I started to think, well, there's really something to this question of how do you hold a good conversation, that it's not simply about answering correctly, but it's a lot more than that. And so really the lesson for me was trying to learn exactly and explicitly what are the qualities of a human conversation that make it rich enough that it can't be approximated by software.
I was wondering about this a couple of weeks ago. I was ordering something online, and, you know, one of those little screens pops up that says, do you want some immediate help, and you speak online. Was that probably a computer, or was that a human being talking to me?
Well, I know that increasingly online customer service is moving towards these chatbot systems, and that's been a lot of the financial, juice in the chatbot industry has been developing these programs to do customer service. So I know, for example, that everyone from IKEA to the United States Army is now having these chatbot kind of avatars or personas on their website fielding questions. And I happen to know also from these sort of murmurs that I've heard in the industry that there are a number of companies beginning to implement chatbot technology without making it very clear to the user that that's what's going on.
It would seem very obvious that you could simply use humor and let a judge know that you were a real person, but this is also something that you found you have to sort of apply with caution.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That there are certain types of jokes that, the question is really, you can program a computer to tell a joke. You can program the joke in, and the computer can repeat it. But what's much trickier is to get the computer to invent a joke.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can create a computer that's a very good storyteller and that has a lot of really funny anecdotes. But it's extremely hard to make a computer with wit because it's so much about this quickness, this wordplay, this responding to the exact kind of phrasing that the person you're talking to most recently said. So it's funny that different types of humor, you know, prove to be more or less susceptible to chatbot mimicry.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phones to Rob in Allen. Hi, Rob.
Hi. First, let me say that I have a degree in computer science, and I have worked in the field, although I'm not a researcher. My concern is the classic one, don't laugh, but it's, the takeover of the world by robots. My concern has to do with looking down the road that we are very good at giving processing power to machines. They're getting more and more capable all the time. I think we can do that. But if you look at, you know, again, Hollywood's examples of The Matrix and Terminator and so on, that's Hollywood's interpretation. But I think the kernel of truth in that is that we can make machines that are big and strong and can make their own decisions, but we can't make them empathetic. And there's going to come a time where we're going to be in real danger if we can't impart empathy to these machines.
What do you think about that, Brian?
Well, there are a couple of reactions that I have. I tend to be a little bit more optimistic about the future of AI than the sort of Terminator and Matrix scenario. I think part of it, though, is that there's a lot to be said for the fact that computer software, as it exists, cannot make its own value judgments about the relative value of things. So if you think about chess as an example, you can tell a computer system the goal is checkmate, and the system can then work out a series of relative judgments based on that, like the queen appears to be worth 9 times what the pawn is worth, and so on. But computers can't do what humans have to do all the time, which is go into a situation and make this really tough call about which of two things is more important. You know, I can't go to my niece's baby shower and my friend's wedding on the same day. So which thing do I go to? That becomes this ethical problem because there's not sort of a clear policy ahead of time for which is the more important thing. And so I think when it comes to computer systems, increasingly doing things that involve human life, for example, driving cars or that sort of thing, you can imagine it's quite easy to program a computer to swerve to avoid accidents. But if the swerving involves risking someone else's life, now ethics have entered into it, and that becomes the thing that really humans maintain the sort of unique ability to come up with those sorts of judgments.
And even our minor decisions, this has been demonstrated by Oliver Sacks and a host of other researchers, many of our minor decisions come down to our emotions, which is another thing that computers, at least as far as we can see for now, don't and can't possess.
That, for me, is one of the interesting stories of the development of the computer, which is that we have often fancied ourselves as this completely rational species. You know, the foundation of fields like linguistics and economics is based on this model of human beings as perfectly rational. And at the end of the 20th century, we increasingly discover all of these examples of irrational human behavior. But we typically think of them as weakness or foibles or mistakes. And so, you know, we tend to think about decision-making in the context of how to avoid letting emotions, you know, sour our decision-making process. What I think is so fascinating is that the further along AI progresses, the more that we discover, for example, that there are certain types of decisions in which emotion is crucial, not, in fact, a detriment at all. So one example is there have been a number of cases where someone has gotten brain damage to a part of the brain that is involved with emotion, and they find it impossible to make certain very simple everyday decisions, like, do you sign this document with a blue pen or a black pen? And there's no logical answer to that question. You simply have some sort of affinity for one or the other, or you have some sort of impulse for one or the other. And that without this emotional process that sort of, you know, instinctively attaches itself to one pen over the other, you'll find that some of these patients will literally halt for a good 20 minutes trying to decide which pen to sign their contract with.
Well, I guess what it is that it's hard to account for nuance when you're programming artificial intelligence. The reality that, you know, deciding between a blue and black pen should be easy and we can move on to something else is also related to the fact that emotion gets us into a lot of trouble when we make the wrong decisions. And it's hard to sort of fashion a computer brain in our own image without deciding either it will or it will not have our ability to make emotion-based decisions.
Yeah. And increasingly, of course, we are making decisions with the help of computers,
mm-hmm.
That we are, you know, feeding them certain information and letting them sort of process it and come back to us with some sort of verdict. But, you know, ultimately, as we've said, it's the human process of deciding what decisions need to be made and what things are the most important priorities. That's really governing that process at the highest level.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who wants to know whether you foresee computers becoming self-aware.
I would say it it doesn't strike me that there's any reason to think that they won't be eventually. I think that typically the way that software is written does not leave a lot of room for that. But on the other hand, I think I'm one of those people who thinks of the mind in some sense as this giant computer. That I don't think there's anything intrinsic to the biology of neurons that have, you know, the cellular structure. I don't think there's anything intrinsic to that substrate that gives us self-awareness. I think self-awareness comes from the way that the brain is able to create a model of itself. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't do that on the computer, but we certainly don't know how to yet. So I'll be as interested as anyone else in seeing how that happens, or if.
So when you're sitting there and you have 5 minutes to text back and forth with this judge, and you're in two separate locations, I take it, so you can't see one another.
That's right.
Is that enough time? And what do you want to work into that 5 minutes to prove that you are Brian Christian, human being?
Yeah, as I say in the book, you know, it's reminiscent at some level of a speed date where you're sort of thrown together with this perfect stranger. You have a very limited amount of time to try to make a really good impression on them. And so for me, a big part of the challenge was, for example, not merely wanting to give correct answers. So if they'd ask me, what is the weather like this morning? Not only would I correctly answer, you know, rainy, but I would also give a sort of emotional reaction. I'd say it's rainy and gross. And then I would also try to find a way to anchor it into my own life narrative. So I might say something like, oh, it's rainy and gross. But, you know, I'm living in Seattle now, so that's pretty much par for the course. So my goal was to try to volunteer this excess of context, not merely to give the right answer, but to give a, in some sense, me answer.
Brian Christian is my guest. His new book is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Brian Christian. He has degrees in poetry, philosophy, and computer science. His new book is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Another thing, Brian, that you thought about was the strict turn-taking that might indicate that you were not a human being. If you let the judge speak, then you spoke, and then you put something out. Sometimes you would rapidly fire four different entries before the judge had a chance, right, to respond?
Yeah, it was really a mixture of a bunch of different things. One of the great discoveries for me was that we typically think of communication in terms of, you know, saying the right things or having the correct answers. But in real life, navigating a conversation, so much of it is about the rhythm of the conversation. So not only knowing what to say, but knowing when to interject, how long to continue for, when to sort of yield the floor or try to hold the floor, that these are extremely intricate negotiations that happen when people talk to each other, especially in large groups. So we've all sort of had that experience around a table with five or six people. And a big part is not only understanding what's being said to you or what's being directly asked of you, but having to negotiate when to sort of pipe up and put a word in edgewise or sort of let someone finish their story or try to get a few words in but ultimately let them continue. That there's an awful lot of negotiation that's happening at the structural level of conversation.
And even little words like and we think of those as being mistakes within a conversation, but in fact they're pretty important placeholders.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the fascinating linguistic revolutions of the past couple decades has been this increasing interest in words that were previously considered just noise. So words like and which are actually turning out to have this legitimate linguistic function. So as a great example, in the Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter versus the IBM supercomputer Jeopardy match, there was one category in particular where the humans totally shut out the computer, and it had to do with actors who direct. So there was a great example where the clue was just the word milk. So Trebek says, milk. And Ken Jennings immediately buzzes in and goes, who is Sean Penn?
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the computer has come up with the answer, Sean Penn. So the computer has actually gotten the answer before Ken Jennings. But Ken Jennings had this instinct, you know, 1 or 2 seconds in advance of, and that's what led him to buzz in. So there's something fascinating and not fully yet understood about this human process of knowing that you know something before you actually know what it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Walt in Dallas. Hi, Walt.
Hey, good afternoon. I just wanted to thank you for your program. And a quick question for Mr. Christian. You gave a couple of examples for AI where a queen could be taught that it's worth 9 times a pawn, or making a more difficult human decision between going to a niece's shower versus a friend's wedding. My question is, to what extent is the weighting of variables a solution of applying simple logical algorithms to helping AI become more human?
What do you think, Brian?
So the question is, to what extent are algorithms able to sort of process through these different things and weight them appropriately?
Mm-hmm.
Am I understanding that?
I think that's right.
I think, in general, we are finding ourselves increasingly able to do that. That one of the great revolutions in artificial intelligence was moving from what were known as expert systems, where if you wanted to create a computer program that would do accounting or chess or something, you would interview accountants or you would interview chess grandmasters, and you'd say, tell me exactly how you think. What, step by step, what's going through your mind? And for processes that we can fully articulate and we can say, well, and I knew that I would give up the knight, but I would get 3 pawns, and I knew that that was a pretty good deal. Those were among the first things to get encoded into software. For other things where humans are not fully able to articulate what is even going through their head, those have been much greater challenges. So if you look at a photograph and say, oh, I recognize that's my dad in that photograph, someone might say, well, how did you weight the nose shape compared to the ear shape? Or what exactly was the ratio of the importance of eye color to the importance of, you know, beard or something? Mm-hmm. We don't know. We just have this gut feeling. And so it was really looking at the biology of the brain that led to the development of what are called neural networks, which is software that simulates the brain at sort of a neural level. And what we find with neural networks is we are able to assign weights to these seemingly ineffable qualities. But I think that ultimately, as we were discussing before, there is a human being kind of ultimately driving the show and ultimately assigning the ultimate value or the ultimate goal. And it's up to the computer to then fill in the relative weights of other things in achieving that particular end. But what I think of as, at least for the moment, distinctly human, is approaching a situation and deciding, sort of from square one, what the appropriate end goal ultimately is.
In preparing for your victory as Most Human Human 2009, what did you learn from studying the human beings who lost that title in previous years?
It's fascinating for me to go back and see the cases where, you know, things went wrong. So, for example, there was a very well-known case in the early 90s where one of the human confederates was a Shakespeare expert. And so her approach was to say, you know, computers don't truly understand things like literature. So my goal in these conversations is just to divulge as much knowledge and understanding and interpretation and reference of these Shakespeare plays as I possibly can cram into these 5-minute conversations. And the sort of ironic and hilarious thing was that it completely backfired, where the judges said, no one knows that much about Shakespeare. This is definitely a computer. So mere knowledge or mere expertise does not seem to be successful, especially now. And so it's much more a question of these sort of intuitive things, of trying to respond in a highly contextual and highly sort of personalized way that paints a picture of yourself as more than the sum of your parts, but this sort of distinct breathing personality.
You know, it occurs to me, we just did it right there with the and telling me that you had more to say. I sort of drew in a breath and you said and I thought, okay, I don't need to say anything yet because Brian's continuing. And that happens 1,000 times a day and we never notice it.
We don't. And for me, that was the beauty of the book, and that was the beauty of my process of preparing for my role as a Confederate, which was looking at these artificial imitations of conversation became a way to appreciate all the, I think, unsung complexities of these everyday interactions.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we have Paul in Dallas on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi. My question has to do with nonverbal communication, because it seems to me that when we talk about the computer and what it has programmed into it, a lot of that deals with verbal communication, the actual words, the meaning of words, that kind of thing. But then what communications experts tell us is that that's only about 7% or so of communication. So will the computer eventually begin to understand nonverbal communication, or are we, because of the way we interact with the computer, giving up so much of our nonverbal communication by being so focused and so allowing the computer to govern the way we do everything that we do, communication and everything else? Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. And I think that's one of the great dangers, honestly, of the current moment that we find ourselves in historically, which is that not only have we prized, you know, word choice over and above things like tonality and facial expression and body language for the purposes of this philosophical experiment, this Turing test, but in fact we've separated language from those other things in the way that we communicate. So increasingly we're talking over email, we're sending text messages, we're tweeting this, and we're posting this to Facebook. And in fact, I think there's an argument to be made that we risk actually losing that skill or that richness of interacting in those other modes. And so for me, one of the great takeaways that I got from, you know, looking at these strictly verbal conversations, as you say, it's really only a thin slice of what is transmitted between people in a real live interaction. Increasingly, I just found myself extremely excited to sit down across a table with a person and look them in the eyes and sort of experience all that richness that we don't always realize we're giving up, but we are.
And the great irony is that before we got to this part, I mean, I guess there aren't a whole lot of human telephone operators left, but there's the example that in the interest of what we thought was efficiency, for a long time, we trained telephone operators to act very much like one of these chatbots.
Yeah, that's right. That there's this interesting intermediate phase before the job gets taken over by artificial intelligence software running on a computer, where you can basically think of it as artificial intelligence software being run on people, that they're sitting there with their human mind that's infinitely capable of responding in this nuanced and unique way, but instead they're being made to respond in a highly regimented, sort of rule-based, policy-oriented way. And that, again, is one of the dangers that... And I think it's one of the things that the Turing test really shows us, is that it's not merely enough to simply be a human being, but you actually have to be interacting in a legitimately human way. So you can imagine that talking to one of these telephone operators and talking to a computer program, it would be much easier for the computer program to pass the Turing test, because basically the operator is behaving like a chatbot. And so that, for me, is one of the the real message is that, you know, looking at the way the software is built, it's not merely a pat on the back at what we're good at and what we take for granted. I mean, part of it is a sense of greater appreciation, but it's also really a call to action, which is that we have these skills and we don't always use them. And when we do that, we risk sort of sinking to the level of these programs. And having the example of knowing how these programs work, I think, spurs us a little bit to go that extra distance and really draw on what makes us special.
What happens to humankind at the point that the Turing test is passed and surpassed and becomes something that, that seems laughably, sort of has a laughably low bar?
Typically, when you think of these various benchmarks for artificial intelligence, you know, once the Deep Blue supercomputer was able to beat Garry Kasparov at chess, IBM basically pulled the plug on the project. They said, okay, well, we're done with that. And similarly, it seems highly unlikely that there's going to be a Jeopardy rematch. And in fact, the sponsor of the Turing test, Hugh Loebner, has said that once the computers reach a certain threshold of deceiving the judges, he'll pull his funding out of the test and will stop holding it. But to my mind, that misses out on one of what I think of as the really intrinsic, fundamental human things, which is that we are so incredibly adaptive. You know, in any situation that something isn't working out, our first instinct is to figure out, well, what can we do to change our approach? How can we kind of go back to the drawing board and take a fresh look at this? And so in that way, I'm actually extremely excited to see what happens when computers first pass the Turing test. Because I think to some extent it'll be a bit of a wake-up call or a sort of a slap in the face of, wow, you know, these computer programs are indistinguishable from the way that we talk to each other. How can we talk to each other in a richer way? And so I'll be very interested to see what happens the next year. How is it that the humans sort of react and come back stronger, come back better? And for me, that's an exciting prospect.
Do you think more computer science students should do what you did and double major in philosophy?
I think, you know, it was a combination that seemed unusual at the time. I raised a number of eyebrows, at least within my own extended family, of, you know, what are you going to do studying something so technical and then something so abstract? But for me, the mind presents this amazing nexus of those two things.
I'm afraid to have to jump in here, but we are out of time. Brian Christian's new book is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Brian, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.